Well, great. Thank y'all. And thanks again for your kindness to Sarah and I. It's been great to be back here in Oxford. And so this is kind of my other hat, right? So for many years, I've had congregational ministry as a hat, but I'm also Chancellor Professor of Church History at RTS, and I've taught across the system. And one of the things in working on 19th and 20th century Presbyterianism, especially in the American South, that I've wrestled with is, as Les was saying, is our racial history and some of our legacy with our racial history in the Presbyterian tradition here in the United States. And and one of the things, if you do 19th and 20th century American South, that you wrestle with is not just racial failure, but where are those places where there's actual possibility of interracial exchange? Where are there examples of a better pathway? And one of the things that I came to realize over time was that really Presbyterianism offers that. Because unlike Baptist traditions, Methodist traditions, African Americans stay in the Presbyterian Church. And so it began to kind of wrestle. I began to wrestle with, oh, okay, well, what are the stories of Black Presbyterians? And how might we be informed by those stories today? So I want to tell you about three starting points for trying to lean in to wrestling with the lost legacy of African-American Presbyterianism. And the first starting point was my own personal and professional realization. I received my PhD from Westminster Theological Seminary up in Philadelphia, and my area was the American Reformed tradition. And that program was 16 seminars. I took 9 seminars with Daryl Hart, D.G. Hart, who's a noted American religious historian. He's done a lot on Presbyterian history. His kind of key book was on J. Gresham Machen. The stunning realization was I started that program in 94, graduated in 2002, and at no point in thinking about the American Reformed tradition did we talk about Black Presbyterianism. We talked about African Americans as a theological problem for us to solve, particularly in regards to white rationalizations of slavery. I wrote my dissertation in my first book on Robert Louis Dabney, the Southern Presbyterian theologian. Obviously, Dabney has a lot to say about African Americans, most of it super bad. We wrestled with, if you will, theological racism and the way white Presbyterians justified holding Black brothers and sisters in bondage. But we really never talked about, and I never knew about, and throughout my entire PhD program, never knew about, wow, there were these Black Presbyterian pastors, largely in the North, who were peers of white Presbyterians in their own presbyteries. And there were all these opportunities for racial interchange. And so what might we learn from that? Never was mentioned. Along that line, right after I finished my PhD, I wrote this book called On Being Presbyterian, which was really meant to be a kind of an introductory manual to Welcome to the PCA, basically, the beliefs, practices, and stories that shape Presbyterian identity. So there's a whole third part of that book where I talk about Presbyterian stories, and I overview Presbyterian history in about 120 pages or so. At no point anywhere in the book did I talk about Black Presbyterians. So this was a huge kind of gaping hole in my education, my training, and in some of the things that I had worked on early in my professional life. Another starting point, though, was a kind of pastoral wrestling. Les and I's mutual friend, Elbert McGowan, recommended a book to me several years ago now by a sociologist named Corey Edwards called That Elusive Dream, The Power of Race in Interracial Churches. Dr. Edwards studied with Michael Emerson, who was the author with Christian Smith of a hugely important book on the study of race in American evangelicalism called Divided by Faith. And part of what Emerson and Smith argued in Divided by Faith is that after from a sociological perspective, trying to understand how especially white evangelicals thought about race, but also how their black evangelical cohorts, also fellow Christians, thought about race. What is the way forward to solving the racial crisis in our country? They argued the way forward is to plant interracial churches. So Corey Edwards comes behind and says, okay, did that work? what are some of the challenges and realities in interracial churches? And one of the things that she discovers is that there's conflict in interracial churches. Interracial churches tended to default to what she called white forms of worship, white doctrine, and white government. Church government. And she uses a number of examples to show how that's the case. But as I was reading the book, I started to wrestle, not simply even with the findings. I don't doubt the findings, but I wondered what does white worship look like? Or what does white doctrine look like? Or what does white church government look like? I grew up, as I mentioned, I don't know if I mentioned or not. My parents came to Christ when I was 10. But I've got a pretty circuitous route in my religious upbringing. Was called to preach when I was 16 years old in an independent fundamental Baptist church setting, in which my first sermons as a 16-year-old preacher boy were in these country Baptist churches in Virginia, where we preached. It was kind of call and response, you know, and I'd be preaching along, and the folks in the congregation with their handkerchiefs, you go on, boy, keep preaching, go on, go, go. And so it was more call and response than is typical, say, in our circles, right? And I had friends who were old line Pentecostals whose church worship services, though they were all white folk, looked a whole lot more similar to Black Baptist or Black Pentecostal traditions than they did to white Presbyterianism, which then kind of made me wonder, okay, well, are there differences or similarities between white and black Pentecostal worship, doctrine, government, or extended a little further? Are there differences between white and black Presbyterian worship, doctrine, government? Is there any such thing as a transracial worship, doctrine, church, government? How did black Presbyterians worship in the 19th century? Why did they hold the Westminster standards? How did they practice church discipline? And what does all that mean for us today? Because really, you study the past for wisdom for today. What does it mean for us today as we seek to plant interracial churches? Is that a good thing? Should we be doing that? And if so, how do whites and blacks together, loyal to the standards, the Westminster standards, which we, I think, all would agree to, what are the ways in which we might move forward together? So there's a pastoral wrestling behind all of this in terms of trying to understand the past for the benefit of the present. The final observation or starting point was a historical observation, namely that the historic black church, when we kind of historically talk about the historic black church, we're talking about six key groups. The African Methodist Episcopal Church, sometimes called the AME Zion, the colored, now called Christian Methodist Episcopal Church, the National Baptist Convention, the Progressive National Baptist Convention, and the Church of God in Christ. In terms of dates for those groups, as early as 1794, as late as 1901, but those six denominations make up what we typically think of as the historic black church. Notice there's one denomination that's not represented there, right? You've got Pentecostal groups, you got Baptist groups, you got Methodist groups, but you don't have a Presbyterian group. And that's because there's no separate black Presbyterian denomination that becomes part of the historic black church, and that's because our black Presbyterian forefathers remained in majority white denominations, and they sought interracial cooperation and integration. They didn't want their own denomination. As you'll hear me say again here in a minute, this is their church. The Presbyterian church is their church, and it's always been, all the way back to 1807 when the first black Presbyterian church is planted in Philadelphia. African-American Presbyterians firmly believed this is their church. They didn't want another. And as part of being part then of the Presbyterian church, they sought to hold their white brothers and sisters accountable to the biblical norms of justice and love in the shared context of mission. In other words, they said, this is what we believe, and we're going to hold you to it. And so what does that mean as we live our common life out together? So those three kind of starting points, a personal starting point, a historical starting point, and a pastoral starting point, kind of led me on into this journey. Yeah.
Can you repeat when that church started?
I'll say it again, 1807. Yeah. So with that in mind, I want to kind of introduce you to some of our Presbyterian forefathers. One of the things that if you've been at any kind of PCA higher court thing, whether a presbytery or a general assembly, you will hear a speech that begins, "Fathers and brothers." Well, these are our fathers and brothers, and I think they need to be just as known to us as Hodge, Thornwell, Dabney, Machen. We need to be able to roll off our tongues, Gloucester, Gremke, Garnett, Theodore Wright, and others. So with that in mind, let me tell you about, and I'm sorry that the screen there isn't super great because you can't see John Gloucester's face super great, but the first black Presbyterian churches that were started in Philadelphia and New York. And that makes sense because if you think about beginning of the 19th century, where are there concentrations of free blacks? The largest concentration of free blacks in America at the beginning of the 19th century is in Philadelphia, second largest New York, third largest Boston. Eventually, Washington, D.C. will surpass both New York and Boston, and Washington, D.C. will become a center place for the emerging black elite, sometimes called the African-American aristocracy. But because those cities are where you have the highest concentration of free African Americans, it makes sense that you would have churches started among them. The first African American church that started in Philadelphia in 1807, and it's connected to a man named John Gloucester. Gloucester is actually called by a group that called themselves the Philadelphia Evangelical Society. That mission organization grew out of the interest of Archibald Alexander. You might know that name. He was one of the founders of Princeton Seminary and the first faculty member at Princeton. Alexander, in 1807, was the pastor of Third Presbyterian Church, sometimes called Old Pine Presbyterian Church, in Philadelphia. He has a heart to reach these free blacks in Philadelphia, and so... He starts this missionary society, and he begins to look for someone who might be able to evangelize and form this church. Eventually, he becomes aware of John Gloucester. Gloucester, and this there's only been really one history written of Presbyterians, African Americans, and Presbyterianism. 1966, a man named Andrew Murray wrote "Presbyterians and the Negro." He writes. Gloucester had been a slave of Gideon Blackburn, the so-called Presbyterian apostle to the Cherokees. Blackburn was operating in East Tennessee, and Blackburn owned Gloucester. He also owned other several slaves. But as his views on slavery became more liberal, that is, he began to wrestle with whether he should hold these slaves, he emancipated several of them and sent them to Liberia. Blackburn and others were supporters of the American Colonization Society. More on that in a minute. So through Blackburn, Alexander becomes aware of John Gloucester. So Blackburn agrees to release Gloucester to freedom, and Gloucester goes to Philadelphia and is eventually licensed and ordained to preach among free blacks in Philadelphia. They will form First African Presbyterian Church there in Philadelphia. Unfortunately, though Blackburn frees Gloucester, he doesn't free his wife and children. One of the first tasks that Gloucester finds it necessary to do is he has to be absent from his church for several years, according to Murray, in his efforts to raise $1,500 to purchase the freedom of his wife and their four children. To that end, he receives help from former Presbyterian Benjamin Rush. Benjamin Rush will be associated with Presbyterians, but he's really a Unitarian. And Rush will say, "At present, Gloucester preaches to crowds of his African brethren in his schoolhouse every Sunday, and to very great acceptance. The prospects of his usefulness to them are very great." So Rush helps Gloucester raise money in order to get his wife and children out of slavery. It's a weird thing that Blackburn will release Gloucester, but he won't release his wife and children, even though he'll be persuaded later to send many of his slaves to Liberia in the colonization scheme. Regardless, John is released. He plants First African Church, and his sons will eventually also be involved in ministry. So Jeremiah Gloucester, his oldest son, will become the pastor of Second African Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia in 1824. James, the middle son, will go to New York and will pastor Siloam Presbyterian Church in Brooklyn. And Stephen, the youngest son, would be licensed as an evangelist by Lombard Street Central Church, one of the most important African-American churches in Philadelphia. William Still, not William Still, the Scottish Presbyterian, but William Still, who was the father of the Underground Railroad, was actually a ruling elder at Lombard Street. So these three Black Presbyterian churches, First African, Second African, and Lombard Street, will be vitally important for antebellum Black Presbyterianism in Philadelphia. Several years after First African is planted in Philadelphia, a young African-American journalist named Samuel Cornish will feel called to the ministry. And so he's licensed to preach at First African Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia, and then will be sent to New York in order to plant the First Presbyterian Church, Black Presbyterian Church in New York City. In 1824, First Colored Presbyterian, as it was called, was organized. Samuel Cornish would eventually start Second Colored Presbyterian in New York City as well. But his real importance, I have it here. Samuel Cornish's real importance, not only is as a pastor, he will also start the first Black Presbyterian newspapers. He would start a Black newspaper named Freedom's Journal. And Cornish will use that newspaper to rebut all sorts of racist claims, especially in connection with the American Colonization Society. The American Colonization Society starts in the late 18-teens as a scheme for raising money to purchase freedom for African Americans out of slavery and then to pay for their passage back across the ocean to a place that's been purchased for them, a place of land that we know as Liberia. The capital of which, Monroeville, is named after James Monroe, one of our presidents, who was a significant backer of the colonization scheme. A number of Presbyterian leaders are supporters of the American Colonization Society. Two of them, founders of Princeton Seminary, Archibald Alexander, who helped start First African Presbyterian Church, and Samuel Miller. They were the two founding faculty members at Princeton. Cornish would attack the Colonization Society with such ferocity that eventually Archibald Alexander and Samuel Miller would push back in significant ways. So Alexander would say this in response to Cornish's attacks on the Colonization Society. He said, it behooves those who industriously sow prejudices against colonization in the minds of the free people of color to consider what injury they may be inflicting on them and their posterity. If I were a colored man, I would not hesitate a moment to relinquish a country where a black skin and the lowest degree of degradation are so identified that scarcely any manifestation of talent, scarcely any course of good conduct, can entirely overcome the contempt which exists. That's Alexander, who had helped start a Black Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia a decade or so later, defending colonization by suggesting that black skin and degradation are so connected, at least in the minds of Americans, that America is a hostile place and it would be better to leave. Samuel Miller publicly attacked Cornish's newspaper and warned the black editor to soften his criticism of the Colonization Society, or as he said, the paper would lose its white subscribers. Getting only a rebuke in response, Samuel Miller wrote in the New York Observer that he was cutting off his subscription to Freedom's Journal, being entirely dissatisfied with the spirit and apparent tendency of that newspaper. Students and other faculty at Princeton followed Miller's lead. What was Cornish saying that was so objectionable? The main thing that Cornish was saying about colonization, especially in upbraiding both the Presbyterian founders of the Colonization Society and these Presbyterian leaders who supported it, what was so objectionable? He said, I want to stay. This is my country. This is where I was born. My people didn't ask to come here, but now that we're here, don't send us back. It's wrong for us to be put in a position of saying that you don't want us here. And especially for other Presbyterians to be saying this about a Presbyterian minister, it was a particular blow. Cornish would eventually, because Freedom Journal would lose subscriptions through the influence of Miller and others, he would eventually start two other newspapers, a newspaper called The Rights of All and a newspaper called The Colored American. By the way, I think David Swift has actually passed away. His estate owes me a lot of royalty dollars because I promote this book everywhere. The single best book, if you want to know about Black Presbyterianism before the Civil War, is this book called Black Prophets of Justice, which is in paperback now from Louisiana State University Press. The subtitle is Activist Clergy Before the Civil War. One of the things that Swift argues is that while Black Methodists and Black Baptists are far more known by historians, it was actually Black Presbyterians and Black Congregationalists, that is, those who were committed to the Reformed system of doctrine, who were far more important for advocating for Black justice, Black rights in antebellum America than anyone else, which is, again, something we don't know about, and we don't know the names of the folks that he talks about. Than any other religious folk, from any other denomination. It was Black Presbyterian clergy especially who were vitally important. So Samuel Cornish is another Presbyterian we ought to know. Yet another is Theodore Wright. Theodore Wright was actually the first Black graduate from an American theological school or seminary. He graduated from Princeton. And he would serve as the pastor of First Colored Presbyterian Church in New York City from 1928 to 1947. He would actually follow Samuel Cornish. Cornish had been had become exhausted trying to raise funds for a building for his church in New York City. His white allies in the presbytery had promised him financial support, not just to support him, but actually support to actually build the building. But because of his advocacy for African-American rights in the pages of his newspaper, suddenly his white allies backed away from him. And he was unable to raise the funds and exhausted himself in the bargain and so had to step away from his church. Theodore Wright would come after him and not only rebuild the membership, but also he was able to secure the funding to build a church for First Colored Presbyterian. Under his leadership, the church grew from 75 members to 413 members. But Wright was also important in helping to start the American Anti-Slavery Society. So in the history of abolitionism in America, the American Anti-Slavery Society was associated with William Lloyd Garrison. And so one of the he had two Black Presbyterian board members as part of the American Anti-Slavery Society, Theodore Wright and Samuel Cornish. Eventually, the Garrisonites would have a battle among themselves about the propriety of using politics in order to advance abolitionism. Garrison was against a political solution. Men like Lewis Tappan and Garrett Smith and others were for using a political solution. That political solution would eventually lead to the creation of the Liberty Party in New York, which was a predecessor organization of the Republican Party that we know today. Wright and Cornish would side with Tappan and Garrett Smith, and the American Anti-Slavery Society would divide, and Wright would go with those who favored a political solution. In other words, Theodore Wright is a hugely important person, both as a Presbyterian pastor, but also in terms of fighting for African-American rights in our country. He's someone that we ought to know and celebrate. But he also was important not just because of his involvement in these anti-slavery societies. He also started an organization called the Phoenix Society, which was dedicated to educating African-American young men who were most of them working 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, in order to try to provide for themselves and their families. They didn't have an opportunity for more education. And so the Phoenix Society started in order to provide education for young black men after they got off work. We're going to meet someone who's actually trained through a Phoenix Society here in a minute. But Wright was instrumental. He didn't just simply, in other words, spirituality to his people and then leave them to do their best. He advocated in the society through the Anti-Slavery Society, and he provided education, knowing that that was the surest way to uplift. He was also unafraid to speak out when it was appropriate. So in 1837, he gave a speech at the New York State Anti-Slavery Society Convention held at Utica, Utica, New York. So this is 1837. For those of you who are complete Presbyterian history nerd people, 1837 is when the old school and new school divide. So the Presbyterian Church splits, and one of the reasons, among the many reasons it splits, is over slavery. Wright will end up in the New School Presbyterian Church, but he gives this speech concerning prejudice against the colored man, was the title of this speech. In the midst of the speech, he says, "This is serious business, sir. The prejudice which exists against the colored man, the free man, is like an atmosphere. It's everywhere felt by him. It's true that in these United States and in this state, there are men like myself, colored with the skin like my own, who are not subjected to the lash, who are not liable to have their wives and their infants torn from them, from whose hand the Bible is not taken. It is true that we may walk abroad, we may enjoy our domestic comforts, our families, retire to the closet, visit the sanctuary, and may be permitted to urge on our children and our neighbors in well-doing. But, sir, we are slaves. Everywhere we feel the chain galling us. It is by that prejudice which the resolution condemns, the spirit of slavery, the law which has been enacted here by a corrupt public sentiment, through the influence of slavery which treats moral agents different from the rule of God, which treats them irrespective of their morals or intellectual cultivation. This spirit is withering all our hopes and oft-times causes the colored parent, as he looks upon his child, to wish he had never been born. Often the heart of the colored mother, as she presses her child to her bosom, filled with sorrow to think that by reason of this prejudice, it's cut off from all hopes of usefulness in this land. Sir, this prejudice is wicked." Remember, 1837. If the nation and church understood this matter, I would not speak a word about that killing influence that destroys the colored man's reputation. This influence cuts us off from everything. It follows us up from childhood to manhood. It excludes us from all stations of profit, usefulness, and honor, takes away from us all motive for pressing forward in enterprises useful and important to the world and ourselves. And he talks about how this plays out. But then he goes on further. He says, "Sir, this prejudice goes. It debars men from heaven. While, sir, slavery cuts off the colored portion of the community from religious privileges, men are made infidels. What, they demand, is your Christianity? How do you regard your brethren? How do you treat them at the Lord's table? Where is your consistency in talking about the heathen, transversing the ocean to circulate the Bible everywhere, while you frown upon them at the door? These things meet us and weigh down our spirits." And, sir, the constitution of society molded by this prejudice destroys souls. I have known extensively that in revivals which have been blessed and enjoyed in this part of the country, the colored population were overlooked. I recollect an instant. The Lord God was pouring out his spirit. He was entering every house and sinners were converted. I asked, "Where is the colored man? Who is weeping for them? Who is endeavoring to pull them out of the fire?" No reply was made. I was asked to go around with one of the elders and visit them. We went and they humbled themselves. The church commenced efficient efforts and God blessed them as soon as they began to act for these people as though they had souls. And, sir, the manner in which our churches are regulated destroys souls. wants the church to throw it open to everybody. And one says, come, come in and share the blessings of the sanctuary. This is the gate of heaven. He says to the colored man, be careful where you take your stand. I know an efficient church in the state where a respectable colored man went to the house of God and was going to take a seat in the gallery. And one of the officers contended with him and said, you cannot go in there, sir. That actually happened to him. He was going to Lewis Tappan's church, who was a white anti-slavery leader, and he was prevented. They had seated themselves, and the usher came and asked them to remove themselves from the sanctuary, and they left the church. In one place, the people had come together to the house of the Lord. The sermon was preached. The emblems were about to be administered. At once, the person who managed the church thought the value of the pews would be diminished if the colored people sat in them. They objected to their sitting there, and the couple colored people left and went into the gallery. And that, too, when they were thinking of handling the memorials of the broken body and shed blood of the Savior. And, sir, this prejudice follows the colored man everywhere and depresses his spirits. And so you hear here the heart of a Black Presbyterian pastor, not a Black Presbyterian pastor from the last 10 years, but from 1837. But I'd suggest that if you listen to our African-American teaching elders in the PCA, they're not going to tell you a story that sounds all that different in terms of the prejudice that they've known, the opposition that they've felt, the sense of overwhelmingness and wondering about the prejudice that they've experienced. I don't think we've gotten as far as we think we have on these issues in our denomination. And Theodore Wright can help us, I think, because he stays in. He stays within Presbyterianism, and he works with his white brothers to try to urge them on to what they are supposed to be. Another Black Presbyterian leader was James W.C. Pennington. Pennington has an amazing story. He actually escapes from slavery and makes his way to Pennsylvania, and eventually we'll get to Brooklyn. Pennington, once he experienced slavery, evidences a profound thirst and hunger for education. And so he's working all day. He's involved in one of these Phoenix societies by night. He learns how to read, but he doesn't simply want to learn how to read and read his Bible. He wants to read theology. He wants to understand more. He's a clear leader, and so he's involved in various Black leadership conventions in Philadelphia and New York. And so through all of this, he becomes involved at Shiloh Presbyterian Church, which is what First Colored Presbyterian Church will rename itself through Theodore Wright's influence. Eventually, he'll pastor a congregational church in New Haven for a time. And while he's there, he actually seeks and is denied admission into the degree program at Yale Divinity School. But they work out a compromise. Pennington is allowed to attend lectures, but he has to sit in the very back of the lecture hall. No one is to really know he's there. He's supposed to come in after class starts, and he's supposed to leave before class ends. He's not allowed to ask any questions. But he agrees to those stipulations, and for 2 years, he attends classes at Yale. Just a few years ago, Yale Divinity School recognized the injustice they had done to Pennington and to others like him, and they publicly confessed their sin and failure in regards to Pennington. And as part of their making good on that confession, they renamed their largest lecture hall Pennington Hall to try to undo some of the damage that they had done. But it shows Pennington's hunger and thirst for learning, and especially for theological learning. Not only is he pastoring, not only is he going to classes at Yale Divinity School, but while he's in Hartford, he will actually publish the first history of African Americans published in America. There's a note here. Wright will start schools. Pennington will write histories. Cornish will edit the first Black newspaper. I mean, there's a pattern here. These men were leaders, and they were determined to not only advance themselves and their people, but to be able to speak in ways so that the gospel would be brought to bear on all of these issues. Pennington would also raise money and sought justice for the fugitives on the Amistad. the famous case that John Quincy Adams was involved with concerning those who were being taken from Africa into slavery, and they seize hold of the ship and bring it into safety in New England. He's involved with that as well. In 1848, Pennington would become pastor of Shiloh Church in New York. But he would take a leave of absence in order to go to Europe on a two-year speaking tour with another Presbyterian minister, Henry Highland Garnett. And he would serve Shiloh until 1855. He's a really significant figure. He'll die in 1870. And he's someone we should know. I just mentioned Henry Highland Garnett. He's another key leader, Black Presbyterian leader, who really straddles before the Civil War and after the Civil War. He too escaped slavery as a child. He's going to end up in New York City. He too is going to go to one of Theodore Wright's Phoenix schools and will eventually make his way to Oneida Institute, which was a school that was funded to bring white and blacks together and train them for ministry. And it was one of those labor schools. So whites and blacks not only studied together, but they worked together. And it was there that Garnett would receive his initial education. He would become pastor of Liberty Street Presbyterian Church in Troy, New York. Liberty Street met in the basement of First Presbyterian Church, Troy. First Presbyterian Church, Troy, was pastored by Nathan S.S. Beeman, who was a leader for abolitionism in the Presbyterian Church. But part of the story is with Black Presbyterianism is that even though white Presbyterians would advocate for Black Presbyterians, they didn't always see them as social equals, right? So Nathan Beeman would worship with his church upstairs, and Henry Garnett would pastor his church downstairs. Even though they shared the same building, they couldn't worship together. First Presbyterian Church, Troy, was advanced in terms of fighting for black rights, but not so advanced as to see blacks as social equals. And that would root in Garnett's heart and shape his story going forward. While he's in Troy, he supports the work of the American Anti-Slavery Society and delivers one of the most important and incendiary speeches in the history of that society. This speech was so incendiary at the time in 1843 that Frederick Douglass, who himself was Presbyterian, both of his weddings were done by Presbyterian ministers, Frederick Douglass actually urged the society not to publish it and, in fact, to suppress it. It took 10 years for this speech to be published. What made it so problematic? Well, this section in particular, Garnett said, "Slavery. How much misery is comprehended in that single word? What mind is there that does not shrink from its direful effects? Unless the image of God is obliterated from the soul, all men cherish the love of liberty. The nice, discerning political economist does not regard the sacred right more than the untutored African who roams the wilds of Congo. Nor has the one more right to the full enjoyment of his freedom than the other. In every man's mind, the good seeds of liberty are planted, and he who brings his fellow down so low as to make him contented with a condition of slavery commits the highest crime against God and man. Brethren, your oppressors aim to do this. They endeavor to make you as much like brutes as possible. When they have blinded the eyes of your mind, when they have embittered the sweet waters of life, when they have shut out the light that shines from the word of God, then and not till then has American slavery done its perfect work. To such degradation, it is sinful in the extreme for you to make voluntary submission. The divine commandments you are in duty bound to reverence and obey. If you do not obey them, you will surely meet with the displeasure of the Almighty. He requires you to love him supremely and your neighbor as yourself, to keep the Sabbath day holy, to search the scriptures and bring up your children with respect to his laws, and to worship no other God but him. But slavery sets all these at naught and hurls defiance in the face of Jehovah. The forlorn condition in which you are placed does not destroy your moral obligation to God. You are not certain of heaven because you suffer yourselves to remain in a state of slavery where you cannot obey the commandments of the sovereign of the universe. If the ignorance of slavery is a passport to heaven, then it's a blessing and no curse. and you should rather desire its perpetuity than its abolition. God will not receive slavery, nor ignorance, nor any other state of mind for love and obedience to him. Your condition does not absolve you from your moral obligation. The diabolical injustice by which your liberties are cloven down, neither God nor angels or just men command you to suffer for a single moment. Therefore, here it is, it is your solemn and imperative duty to use every means, both moral, intellectual, physical, that promises success. In other words, if you need to use violence in order to secure your liberty, you may do so. You can see why that was a little incendiary in 1843. But we have to say that Garnett wasn't wrong. He was right to advocate his people trying to find whatever way possible to seek their freedom. He would be known from that point on as a powerful opponent to slavery. He would eventually pastor Shiloh Presbyterian Church in New York City, 15th Street Presbyterian Church, one of the most important black Presbyterian churches in Washington, D.C. He would serve as president of a black college, Avery College in Pittsburgh, before he would eventually return to Shiloh. But one of the things that happens to Garnett, especially after the Civil War, the high point for Garnett after the Civil War was in 1865, he's invited as the first African-American to address the House of Representatives. And in his speech, which has been published by our friend Caleb Cangelosi, who runs Law College Press, called Let Slavery Die. I wrote an introduction to this, and then you have a biography of Garnett and then his speech from the House of Representatives. And you can actually purchase this at Square Books here in town. He has great hope in 1865 about the future for African Americans in our country. By the end of Reconstruction and beyond, he's become disappointed and even a little cynical. He will be involved in Republican politics after the Civil War, and in 1881, when a Republican comes to office, his request, he knows he's dying, his request is that he might be sent as an ambassador to Liberia, because he hopes that he will die in Liberia so that he can be buried there. He does not want to be buried in America because of the disappointment that he has felt, both from his Presbyterian brothers, but also because of what happens in the country as a whole after the Civil War. Two other folks to mention, and then I'll be done. One is Matthew Anderson. Matthew Anderson, also a graduate of Princeton Seminary, a fifth-generation Presbyterian, will come to Philadelphia in 1879, and he'll stay in Philadelphia for his entire ministry. He'll start a church called Berean Presbyterian Church, but as he's pastoring his people, he realizes they have other needs, and so he starts a penny savings bank. White banks aren't loaning money to start businesses, so he starts a building and loan association. He sees that his folks need manual training, so he starts a training school. White pharmacies aren't dispensing medicine, so he starts a dispensary. When he's trying to provide work for these people, they need care for their children, and likewise, these children need to learn to read, so he starts a kindergarten. The model that Matthew Anderson develops is called an institutional church. There are other institutional churches in Philadelphia, not just social gospel ones, but conservative ones, the most important being Bethany Presbyterian Church, which is pastored by a man named A.T. Pearson, was supported by John Wanamaker, who would Wanamaker, if you're from Philadelphia, you know Wanamaker's, was a huge retail business. He had a five-story building, Wanamaker's building in Philadelphia. So there were conservative examples, evangelical examples, white evangelical examples of an institutional church. Matthew Anderson is profoundly committed to the Westminster Standards, and we'll talk about that in his book, Presbyterianism, What the Negro Thinks, where he tells the story of Berea, but also talks about how African Americans respond to Presbyterianism and why he starts all of these organizations in connection with his church. He's profoundly committed to, if you will, Presbyterian doctrine and polity, but also recognizes the need to care for his people. The other name to know from the postbellum period is Francis Grimke, born into slavery as a result of, in Charleston, South Carolina, as a result of the Civil War, is freed, will be sent to Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, and then Princeton Seminary, and would pastor 15th Street Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C. for 50 years. Twice moderator of Washington City Presbytery, which is a racially mixed presbytery, and very much viewed as a leader within the Presbyterian Church, but also within the Black community. He's friends with Booker T. Washington and will preach at Tuskegee several times. He's friends with W.E.B. Du Bois. He'll sign the call for both the Niagara Conference and to begin the NAACP. He helps to found the American Negro Society and also hosts a group that meets every Friday to discuss great literature and music. His wife was a well-known poet, and his niece would be one of the key players in the Harlem Renaissance. And yet Grimke, with all of this, feels free to speak about issues related to race. So this is a selection from a sermon that he preaches at his church. The Negro will never acquiesce as long as he lives. And he begins by saying, lawlessness is increasing in the South. So this is 1898. Jim Crow begins to be established in 1890 with the adoption of the Mississippi State Constitution. That's really when you kind of, the end of redemption has happened. Jim Crow begins to be established. 1896 is Plessy versus Ferguson, which establishes the rule of separate but equal that gets applied across American society, but especially in the South. Lynching reaches its height between 1890 and 1910. Lawlessness is increasing in the South. After 33 years of freedom, our civil and political rights are still denied us. The 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution are still a dead letter. The spirit of oppression and injustice is not diminished, but increasing. The determination to keep us in a state of civil and political inferiority and to surround us with such conditions as will tend to crush out of us a manly and self-respecting spirit is stronger now than it was at the close of the war. And he'll talk about that. But then he goes on a little bit further, and he says, another discouraging circumstance is to be found in the fact that the pulpits of the land are silent on these great wrongs. The ministers fear to offend those to whom they minister. We hear a great deal from the pulpits about suppressing the liquor traffic, about gambling, about Sabbath desecration, about the suffering Armenians, about polygamy in Utah when that question was up, the Louisiana lottery. They're eloquent in their appeals to wipe out these great wrongs, but when it comes to Southern brutality, to the killing of Negroes and despoiling them of their civil and political rights, they are, to borrow an expression from Isaiah, dumb dogs that cannot bark. Had the pulpit done its duty, the Southern savages who've been sinking lower and lower during these years in barbarism would by this time have become somewhat civilized, and the poor Negro, instead of being hunted down like a wild beast, terrorized by a pack of brutes, would be living amicably by the side of his white fellow citizen, if not in the full enjoyment of all his rights, with a fair prospect at least of having them all recognized. This is the charge which I make against the Anglo-American pulpit today. Its silence has been interpreted as an approval of these horrible outrages. Bad men have been encouraged to continue their acts of lawlessness and brutality. As long as the pulpits are silent on these wrongs, it is vain to expect the people to do anything better than they are doing. So that's 1898 from a key Black Presbyterian voice. So what are some lessons to learn from all of these things? One of the things that I haven't been able to fully tease out for you because of my limited time, but I think is very much the case, is Black Presbyterian leaders taught Presbyterian doctrine because they believed it to be biblical. Theodore Wright's a Princeton graduate. Matthew Anders, a Princeton graduate. Francis Grimke's a Princeton graduate. They all subscribe to the Westminster Standards. They're all students of Charles Hodge. Hodge especially would record how much he appreciated Grimke and his classes. Grimke was in the last class to study with Hodge. Both Grimke and Matthew Anderson would take classes with James McCosh, the president of Princeton College, and were highly respected by McCosh. They loved Presbyterian doctrine because they believed it to be biblical. but they also preached and taught and advocated and organized on racial issues because they desired justice within the church and justice within American society. And they didn't see that as contradictory to or violating the church's spiritual mission. The Bible talks about justice. The Bible talks about racial difference and equality. The Bible presents God's mission to his world as a multi-ethnic, multi-racial people. All of this is fair ground because it's all in the Bible. And so they didn't see it as somehow violating the spirituality of the church, but rather right at the heart of the church's spiritual mission, in fact. These leaders relied on white allies for fundraising and advocacy, especially, as I mentioned, Cornish, but Theodore Wright did in his involvement in the American Anti-Slavery Society. Others did as well. But they sometimes recognized that these white allies were limited and sometimes betrayed their best interests. Though they might desire to help, at times they would pull back in ways that were disappointing. And then finally, these Black Presbyterian leaders show us that both the benefits and frustrations that minority leaders experience as they work within a white majority culture. There's these possibilities of racial interchange that they represent, but these racial interchanges also show the limitations and frustrations that are experienced, especially on our Black Presbyterian leaders' side. And if I could just move to 2022 on that point, one of the things I think that white Presbyterian folk today don't recognize is how much cost there is for our Black and Brown brothers to be part of our denomination. There are over 5,000 teaching elders in the PCA today. Right now, there are somewhere around 60 Black teaching elders and about 35 Latino teaching elders, right? 5,000, 60 Blacks, and about 35 Latinos, so about 100 Black and Brown teaching elders. There's a significant Korean American Presbyterian presence that we've never really fully understood or wrestled with either. Six overlapping regional presbyteries with all the complexities that come with first generation, one and a half generation, second generation, two and a half generation Korean Americans. And we've not leaned in well to any of that minority conversation. And I think it's fair to say for a lot of us, for white teaching elders in the PCA, we don't even think about engaging the conversation. What does that conversation look like, and how do we even have that conversation? But for our minority brothers and sisters in our church, this is a risky place to be. We had Erwin Ince, who is our coordinator, new coordinator for Mission in North America, first African American to be elected moderator of the General Assembly. We had him at IPC last week. And one of the things he said, both publicly but also said to Sarah and I over lunch, was there is not a week that goes by where he doesn't get asked the question, why are you in the PCA? And he gets asked that by white folk in the PCA, Black folk in the PCA, and Black folk outside the PCA. Like, all of those constituencies ask him, why are you in the PCA? And Erwin has to come back again and again to say, well, I believe what we believe is true, but I also believe that this is part of what God's mission is to us and to his world, is to form a multiracial, multiethnic people. And so that's why I'm here. But I don't think we fully account with how, both historically speaking, but also in our contemporary situation, how our minority leaders show us both the benefits and frustrations that they experience. Which means then, as white leaders, we need to be in the posture of listening, but we also need to be in the posture of giving power away. If I can close on this note, Philippians 2 gives us a model for how we are to live in the context of the church. Paul says, don't do anything out of selfish ambition or rivalry. Rather, the mind of Christ is already in you. You already have it. Well, what's that mind of Christ? Christ had glory. He was equal to God, but didn't grasp that glory as something to be held on to, but rather he willingly let it go. And he took upon himself the form of a servant, and he became obedient to death, even death of cross. Why? For us. And that Paul says, that's the mind that you and I have, which means we don't grasp our advantages. We don't grasp our power as something we cling to. It's mine. I'm not going to give it away. No, we let it go and we give it away in order to benefit others, to listen well to others, to invite them to the table, to for them to make the decisions. And we come along simply to support, right? I mean, I wonder how, if, and this was really the heart behind the PCA position paper that was adopted in 2018 of intentionality. What would our church look like in 10 years if with intentionality, the majority culture in the PCA were to say, let's let power go. Let's intentionally give it away. We'll be in the position of learners and listeners. We'll admit we don't have the answers, and we'll listen well to our Black and Brown brothers and sisters in the PCA so that we might together lean into what God's mission is. I think that's something that these Black Presbyterian leaders from the 19th century can teach us a whole lot more about. So hopefully that's been helpful. Thank you.